It's time to get our view from the middle, doing his thing for USA Today. Grab a copy at your local newsstand, online, usatoday.com, on Twitter, at George Schroeder. George, how are you on this wonderful Wednesday?
I'm good. How are you, Steve?
Great. So, a little over a month ago, we talked about the mass layoffs at ESPN. Now it just happened at Fox. And beyond the what direction is sports media headed, I saw the name Stuart Mandel, and I was surprised because I look at him. I mean, I follow him on Twitter. He just has that credibility, and it just always seemed to me the quality of his work is beyond reproach. And I know he's a longtime colleague of yours, also worked at Sports Illustrated. Regardless of the reasoning, how surprised were you to hear this?
Well, to be honest, I knew it was coming just because Stuart and I are friends.
Right.
So when it broke on when he announced it essentially on Twitter and on his podcast yesterday, it wasn't a surprise to me. And I'm not really surprised by anything anymore. And when it comes to the world of sports media, just because the models are changing and people are struggling to keep up. And I'll say this: it isn't just Stuart. Obviously, in a lot of layoffs, a lot of places, including the ESPN ones you referred to, there have been a whole lot of super quality, credible journalists who have been, let go. And at some point, that's likely to happen to a lot of us, and I get that. So I'm thankful for the job I have for the moment, as far as that goes. But I'm not surprised by Fox Sports. What they did was something different reasoning than what ESPN did.
Right.
So, I mean, they're going completely away from the reporting model. ESPN wasn't doing that. They were just sort of cutting back and trimming costs.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but it makes sense. My thought was, if you ran an outfit that covered college football, wouldn't you do everything you can to have Mandel work for you? But like I said, he's a friend of yours, and I just, it doesn't sit well with me.
Well, I think Stuart and some of the people that are friends of mine at ESPN as well and other places are going to land on their feet. There don't appear to be a lot of spots, but I don't have any special insight. I'm not teasing anything, but I think Stuart will land on the street.
I hope so, and I agree. We're getting close to July. Never too early to talk college football. I heard you on Paul Feinbaum. Some great topics. The mess at Mississippi. Payments to recruits. Fixing entrance scores are alleged. How much trouble looms for the program, and off a 5-win season, what kind of trouble is their coach, Hugh Freeze, in?
Well, they've already banned themselves, a self-imposed ban.
Sure.
This year. I think there's some questions whether the NCAA might tack another one on. But, you never know what the NCAA is going to do with that. When it comes to Hugh Freeze, though, he does not stand accused of anything specifically, but under the new NCAA enforcement paradigm, he's been charged with sort of violation of head coach responsibility. The idea being, if it happens in your program, on your watch, you're responsible for it. I mean, the old deal was always, these coaches didn't know anything about it, and it was some low-level staffer, and so the low-level staffer got scapegoated, and the coach got away with it. And that's not to say that sometimes they didn't know about it, but I'm just saying it was an effective way to skirt responsibility. So the NCAA has changed that. What's interesting about and you've seen Jim Boeheim get suspended. We recently saw Rick Pitino get suspended. What's interesting with Ole Miss is they are still scapegoating a low-level staffer and defending their coach to the hilt, at least so far. We'll see if they keep doing that, but it sure seems like they're going to go to the wall with Hugh Freeze. And if that's the case, I don't know how that's going to end so well. I mean, I think he's looking at a suspension of some length, whether it's 3 games or 6 games or whatever. And if you get to 6 games or beyond, I think at that point you're missing. It isn't just that you miss the game, Steve. It's that you can't be involved in any of the preparations for them, which would mean you couldn't be involved in August camp, much less the weeks leading up to all those games inside the season. At that point, do you keep your head coach? Becomes a question, I think.
No, that's a good one. I referred to that rule right out of the gate as the Harry Truman buck stops here rule.
Coaches don't like the buck stops here concept.
I know they
don't. When it comes to NCAA enforcement of rule violations, they have never liked that at all.
I don't blame him, but there's an element of logic to it as we continue with George Schroeder. We had this conversation last preseason. You know, Kevin Sumlin at Texas A&M left Houston after a 12-win season. His first year he had Johnny Manziel upset Alabama. And since then they've been kind of decent but stagnant. Eight wins, never better than 4-4 in the SEC. They lost the top pick in the draft in Myles Garrett. If you had to make an evaluation, what has to happen this year for Kevin Sumlin to be assured of coming back for next year?
Well, they can't go 8-5. Let's just start there. You know, when Scott Woodward, the AD, essentially called out his coach on Feinbaum, of all places, last month during the SEC's annual meetings, and basically said, you know, that Sumlin, something to the effect of, knows he has to win. Well, you know, he didn't put a number on it, but that's unusual. That's not unusual. That's extraordinary for an athletic director to come out and publicly say it, even if everybody knows it. And so for him to do that, I think, puts him on notice that they've got to be really good. First of all, I'm not sure they're going to be really good, but 8-5 again is not going to cut it. I'm not sure that, you know, a 9-win season does it. I think they might have to finish with 10 wins, and I would give you a bowl win in there, but I think you probably have to finish 10-3 at the least. And you know, no, but numbers may not be the deal. It's also, who did you beat?
Yeah, definitely with them,
you know,
especially.
I mean, they're going to have won some games that maybe right now you would look at them and say, I don't think they're going to win those games, in order to show the direction of the program is going to contend at some point very soon for SEC West and SEC championships, and from there you get into the playoff. But, you know, I think that's a tall order for anybody in the SEC West, because there's this specter looming over everyone named Nick Saban.
Yep.
But that's the situation that I think Kevin Sumlin finds himself in, and I think he's the coach who's probably on as big a hot seat or as hot a hot seat as anybody in the country right now.
Now, along those lines, I always call it the catch-up factor. When a force emerges, the primary competition has to figure it out. I mean, you look at, like, say, the AFC East. For 15 years, nobody solved New England. And in the SEC, as you mentioned, Alabama just has taken over. I mean, are they just in a reload dynasty mode? Or are teams just failing to keep up? I guess, is the SEC now Bama as a power and a bunch of maybe posers?
Well, can I take all three of those questions and just say yes and go to the next
yeah,
thing? I mean,
if you
listen,
want.
Nick Saban has – the SEC was the best league. Now, look, your listeners and you and I all got tired of hearing that over and over again, because it wasn't enough to be the best overall deepest league with the best football played every Saturday. We had to hear about it because they had to tell us about it.
Yep.
But it's no longer the best league. It's no longer the overall deepest with a lot of teams that could play for a playoff and national championship. Last year was representative, and maybe it was a little bit of an aberration, but it was representative of where they are right now. Alabama is elite. Alabama is the best program in the country. Alabama is the favorite to win the national title every year until further notice. And further notice means until Nick Saban hangs it up. But the rest of the league, the next closest team had 4 losses. Auburn played in the Sugar Bowl and got walloped by an Oklahoma team that at least earlier in the year wasn't good enough to play with Ohio State. You know, and that was if it hadn't been for the arrangement that the Sugar Bowl has with the SEC and the Big 12 to send teams there when they're not a semifinal, there wouldn't have been a second SEC team beyond Alabama in a New Year's Six Bowl, because there shouldn't have been. And the league is, maybe it's not going to be quite that far down, but you tell me what team looks like a playoff-caliber team other than Alabama, and the answer is, I don't think you can tell me that. There isn't one. So Nick Saban has grinded it down around him just by, lots and lots of praise due to him. He's done a fantastic job. I think he's probably going to go down as the best coach in the history of college football. I think this run, especially if they had to win a national title this year, might go down as the best run in the storied history of college football. You know, they're at 4 national titles in 9 years right now. They're 1 second away from 5-9, and then, you know, Deshaun Watson denied them that yet last year. They could end up with 5 titles in 10 years. Nobody's done anything like that. And by the way, even if you want to go way back and talk about a Notre Dame or whatever, this is a much more difficult time to do it, because it's not based on cosmetic polls when your tradition wins out over sports writers you never saw anybody play back in the day. This is, you got to play it on the field with the playoff.
Yeah, and for folks
and a lot more parity, by the way, with the 85 scholarship rule over the last 25 years, too.
No, I agree. And, you know, folks can go back. You know, you had the UPI and Reuters and the AP and the coaches, and there were a lot of national championships handed out. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know we talked about Lincoln Riley, the new Oklahoma coach, a bit last week, but you visited Norman. I've read about him on Fox, ESPN. I heard him interviewed nationally. It seems like a very unique situation. He's walking into a situation of blue blood, following a legend, high expectations. But is it me, or does it almost seem like consensus among those who follow this game that this young guy is suited to handle this?
No, I think it's you. I mean, I don't think it's you. I think you've discerned the vibe correctly. That said, I think what you just mentioned, he's a first-year head coach. He's only 33, so he's young in the business. He's at Oklahoma, which, you know, has unbelievable standards because it's one of college football's all-time winningest programs at any time, and he's following the winningest coach in program history. And you put all those things together, and while you could say he's set up for success because he's at Oklahoma with all those resources and advantages and the immediate team he's got coming back, which looks loaded, but he may be set up for failure just because that's a tall order for any coach of any kind of resume to walk into, much less a guy who's never coached, who's never made a fourth down call on his own. You know, I mean,
yeah.
So I hear what you're saying, and there's a little bit of a glint of surprise in your voice and in the question that everybody seems to think, wow, he's going to succeed. I'm with you. Look, he's as impressive in person as anybody I've been around in coaching.
Wow.
But that said, he's never had that fourth down call that I just talked about, much less, you know, anything, you know, any of the other things that go around with head coaching. He's gonna be the offensive coordinator in terms of calling. He's not the offensive coordinator, but he's gonna call plays. He's gonna be the quarterback's coach, which is what he was last year, and be the CEO of this program at Oklahoma. And that's to me, I mean, if anybody can pull that off with no experience, maybe it's Lincoln Riley, but I think it's a tall order.
No.
Especially if the fact is that if you go 8-4 3 years in a row, that's not good enough. That's fireable stuff at Oklahoma. That's, you know, they expect you to win the Big 12 and play in the playoff and win a national title.
Well, I just think it's going to be a fascinating storyline to check out.
Agreed.
As the season starts. So there you go. Continue.
Well, and one other thing, too.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the Big 12 and even nationally, Oklahoma-Texas, the Red River rivalry, is such a big rivalry that it's an interesting reboot this year with Tom Herman at Texas, who's not a new head coach, but he's new to Texas, third-year head coach, and then Lincoln Riley. It's fascinating to see what shape the future of that rivalry takes. And it's bigger than either of the two programs. It has the Big 12 future at stake in some ways.
No, it's going to be very, very, very interesting. I know you started the article, as we continue with George Schroeder of USA Today. You were talking about Riley's new office. And, of course, around here, we're familiar with, you know, space-aged bells and whistles facilities. So you got to see this. I know they gave the stadium a facelift, and the football people moved into new quarters. Is it off the charts? Just unbelievable?
Yeah, it is, and it's not completely done. Let me say two things. One, Oregon's facilities are second to none.
Right.
Okay? But two, the big boy football powers have always been upgrading and doing things all along. And so it's not like they're way behind Oregon's. They're on par. The big boys are always doing that kind of stuff. So I'm not trying to take any shots at Oregon's. Oregon's are second to none. Okay?
Yeah.
But when you go to Alabama or Oklahoma or someone, whenever they finish their most recent set of renovations and they're always doing a new renovation, then then they've got that sort of thing that's going on par with that. Texas is doing renovations right now as well. You could go around the country, and especially when you get down to the Southeast or up in Michigan's doing stuff. You know, the big boy old school football factories are always doing that kind of stuff. So Oklahoma's going to be, when it's completely done here in about a month and they get all sort of the signage up and all the little, you know, just the little sort of detail work is what's left. I mean, they're all in it. The coaches are in it, the players are in it, everything else. But the detail work's still going on this summer. Once it's done, it will be as good as anybody in the country as well.
Wow.
You know, so it's not a space age look like Oregon.
Right.
It's more of a, it's built to look like sort of old school campus Oklahoma's campus, even though the school itself isn't stately and old school academics, its campus sort of has a look of something you might see, think you'd see back east. And so the football facility sort of has arched windows and things that look like you'd see on a campus.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of cool in a different way, if that makes sense.
So architecturally different.
Absolutely, architecturally different. Whereas Oregon's is cutting edge, space age, even down to the architectural lines, you know, and the materials used. That's Oregon's. Oklahoma's would be the red brick that goes with the rest of the architecture around the school, and then sort of that old school looking, you know, traditional campus thing that you think of. So, but inside, the bells and whistles are the same. They have fingerprint scanners and things like that. The same. You know, I think Oregon, uses the iris scanner or whatever it is, you know. So,
right.
and it's my understanding that Oregon's, if your iris doesn't actually work, then, like, the lasers come out and cut you apart. That's the other piece, right?
That's very protective of them.
I'm kidding. But, I mean, I think they all have that, or at least the poison darts. Every facility these days has those. But, no, it's a nice place, I guess, and Lincoln Riley has moved into it. And the reason I used that, and the reason I led with that in the story, which is at usatoday.com, is because his actual office, the head coach's office that was designed for Bob Stoops, and in fact, Bob Stoops had begun moving into before he decided, you know what, I think I'm going to hang it up, is 1,800 square feet, Steve. I mean, that's larger than the house, than my first house.
That's larger than my current house.
It's almost larger than my current house. I mean, it's 1,800 square feet, and that's without counting the 20 foot high ceilings.
Wow!
So it feels like it's, you know, 5,000. It feels like a gymnasium. I mean, it's really nice, but it's cavernous. It feels like, I'll tell you what it feels like. It feels like a moderately sized room in an old school college library building.
That's unbelievable. 1,800 square feet. Took me 25 years to save for my house at 1,300 square feet.
Well, part of your problem is you're on the West Coast, where everything costs like a 1.75 of what it costs in, you know. This is Norman America. They probably got it for 50 cents on your dollar.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. All right. Hey, George, you left me with these kinds of crazy visions of protected facilities, but good stuff. And again, catch the piece out, usatoday.com. On Twitter, @ George Schroeder. Have a wonderful rest of the week, weekend, and we look forward to chatting you up once again on Wednesday.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. You guys have a good day.
All right. Take it easy.